This is good hose. You ever order calamari? There's always that piece that looks like a deep-fried tarantula. You can have that one. I'll just stick with a garden hose. Eating barbecue land. Each city in the southeastern part of the United States has its own unique type of specialty food that can be found only in that city, and it all happens to be called barbecue.
Oh, we do it different here.
Of course, barbecue is not exclusively a southern cuisine. Eating barbecue goes as far north as Kansas City, and I've had amazing barbecue in Champaign, Illinois, and Syracuse, New York. But truly, the heart of barbecue is in the South. Touring around the South doing stand-up often feels more like an eating barbecue tour. There is a pride in each city's unique recipe for barbecue. It seems in every southern city you encounter the same guy who brags about the same two things: that a president ate at their famous barbecue place, and that people have it shipped around the world.
Obama ate there, and you can get it shipped wherever you want.
There is such pride in the fact that the local food is mailed to people. I never have the nerve to point out that spam is also delivered all around the world. The subtext of all their boasting seems to be,
you know, we got the best barbecue, and you're a fat guy, so you should get some shipped to yourself.
Lest I be considered rude, I always oblige. I've found barbecue to either be some of the best or worst food I've eaten. There's no in-between. Either it's an amazing meal I can't stop talking about, or I'm angry that I wasted the energy to lift the food to my mouth. Of course, I still finish the whole plate. As I mentioned before, I'm not rude. The inconsistency of the quality of barbecue almost seems to match the inconsistency of the meaning of the word barbecue. When you hear the word barbecue, a multitude of different images come to mind. Some of you may think of the surface on which food is barbecued, for example, a grill. Some of you may think of a gathering of friends. Some of you may think of the sauce. This chicken leg needs more barbecue. You get the idea. Barbecue is a noun, a verb, an adjective, and even a potato chip. Barbecue is one of the only food genres I can think of that has its own acronym, BBQ. This actually started out as barbecue, but continued to get progressively shorter as the person who penned it ate more BBQ. Kansas City. Now, I'm not saying I've tried every type of barbecue in this great land, but my most memorable experience of eating barbecue was not even in the South. It was at Oklahoma Joe's in Kansas City, Missouri. Yes, that's right, a barbecue place in Kansas City named Oklahoma Joe's. That makes as much sense as Kansas City being located in Missouri. To make matters more confusing, this glorious meal was purchased and eaten in a gas station. Not a converted gas station, a functioning gas station. Jeannie and the kids and I were on a bus touring the country, and it was highly recommended to me that I eat at this great barbecue place in a gas station. I figured, why not? If the food's bad, at least it'll be a great experience for the kids to eat surrounded by flammable liquid. When we arrived at 11 a.m., I was surprised to see a line out the door. Not like a line at a cash machine, I mean a long, long line. Initially, I was concerned that the kids wouldn't be able to last, and Jeannie would once again confront me on my supposed unhealthy attachment to food. The kind of unhealthy attachment that would have me risk waiting in a 45-minute line with five kids, and there being no roller coaster at the end. Luckily, I was able to find an open table for Jeannie and the kids, and as I returned to the line, I realized something unique. This substantial line was populated exclusively by men. Predominantly pudgy, balding, exhausted men in their 30s and 40s. I fit right in. The most impressive thing about the line was the fact that all these middle-aged line waiters were happy. At first glance, this would be the crowd that you would never want to be caught waiting in line with. The type of guys who would give up and leave if confronted by a line at the store while picking up some milk or diapers for their kids.
We'll make do. The kids can drink water and pee on a towel. I'm not an errand boy.
As we all know, lines are usually filled with angry people. Not that angry people wait in lines, but a lot of normal folk morph into antsy, angry, resentful people about 5 minutes into the queue. Not this line. You'd think all the men were waiting to turn in a winning lottery ticket, lost in a daydream of impending happiness. Occasionally, one would turn to an absolute stranger behind them and giddily explain, "I'm getting the brisket. What are you getting?" I imagine that at the end of the line, there would be a door that opened into a beam of light. Welcome to Fat Guy Heaven. Come on in. There's always an NFL game on. The beer's free. You don't have to wake up tomorrow. You have no responsibilities. And you can eat all the barbecue you want in the middle of a gas station. Eventually, I got up to the counter to place my order. By the time I returned to the table with two heaping trays of Oklahoma Joe's barbecue, two of our kids were asleep, and the other three were under the table playing Fort. There were empty saltine cracker wrappers, piles of crumbs, and broken crayons all over the table. I'm pretty sure that I saw smoke coming out of Jeannie's ears as she shot daggers at me with her eyes. I guess she didn't want the pulled pork. Who knows? Women. Anyway, the barbecue was delicious, and we could fuel up the bus before we left. Eat and get gas. What a perfect afternoon. Southern comfort. People are just nicer in the South. They are. Even when they're rude, they are polite. Maybe it's the sing-song of the Southern draw, but even a, y'all can go to hell, from a Southerner sounds friendly.
Well, thank you, kindly. You all can go to hell, too, and y'all come back now, you hear?
People in the South are nicer, but they're slower. I don't mean they are slower intellectually. I mean they just move slower.
Fireman, you have to get out of here. Your house is on fire.
Southern guy, all right, I'll leave, but first I have to drink me some sweet tea. Then I'll deal with that pesky house of fire.
Biscuits and gravy. I think I've identified why people in the South behave in such a nonchalant manner. It's the biscuits and gravy. Everyone in the South seems to move like they've just had two helpings of biscuits and gravy. They are moving like you might after Thanksgiving dinner. You know, when you are uncomfortably full but pleasantly satisfied as you drag yourself over to the couch for a nap. That is how everyone below the Mason-Dixon line moves in everyday life. I really believe it's the biscuits and gravy. The feeling you have after eating biscuits and gravy is identical to the feeling of chaining a bowling ball to your foot. Most amazingly, people in the South are eating biscuits and gravy for breakfast. Yes, breakfast. They aren't coming home late at night slurring, I'll eat anything. They are waking up thinking, time for cement. Then at lunch, they are having fried chicken and waffles. And this is all before 2 p.m. It could be that the South will never rise again because they don't have the energy. Most of their cooking involves the same ingredients as paper mache. They are, in essence, eating piñatas down there. I'm convinced this is even the explanation for why Southerners talk the way they do. After you eat biscuits and gravy, you can't be expected to say both the words you and all. After a plate of biscuits and gravy, all anyone can muster is, "Show us some good biscuits and gravy, y'all." Then there's lunch. I never understood how someone rationalized eating fried chicken and waffles in the same meal.
What should we serve with the fried chicken?
French fries? No, something elegant. Like a waffle or a gyro. It's like someone thought, I know it's lunch, but I'd also like to have breakfast and a heart attack. Mind you, I'm not criticizing the biscuits and gravy or the chicken and waffles. I find them delightful. I'm just saying if I lived down there, I would be dead. On one bus tour, I had biscuits and gravy for breakfast for 9 days straight. I still haven't gone to the bathroom. That bus tour was 25 years ago. Grits. You can't really discuss Southern food without bringing up grits. When I reference grits during a stand-up show, Southerners will clap like I mentioned the college they attended or that I support the troops. Being Southern means liking grits. Grits are not for everyone. It's almost as if someone was like, hey, if you like the taste of biscuits and gravy, but without the taste of biscuits and gravy, then you'll love our man-made wet sand. I want to like grits. I try. I order them, but eventually I end up muttering to myself over my plate, are these undercooked? Overcooked? No wonder you guys came up with moonshine. When I've expressed this to Southerners, they always point out, all y'all need to do to the grits is add a pound of cheese, cup of sugar, and 30 candy canes. One of the many things I love about the South is that they don't even try to hide the fact they are eating unhealthy. The following is a reenactment of me ordering in a restaurant in Roanoke, Virginia. Me looking at a menu. I guess I'll have the bucket of lard and the salt stick. Waitress, y'all want that deep fried? Sure. Y'all want to shoot at you while you eat it? Okay. The South seems to be the home of comfort food. While I pride myself on making all food comfort food, there's a uniqueness to the Southern approach. Southern comfort to me just means any food in the South. Southern cooking almost seems to be code for we are not counting calories. You will not find a nutritionist at a Southern boarding house style meal. And if you do, they will only be there to study what not to eat. Looking around at a Southern-style dining establishment below the Mason-Dixon line is very much like seeing cigarette smoke in casinos. You have the sudden realization, oh yeah, you're still allowed to do that here. It's an experience of a different era. Savannah. Allow me to take you along on the journey we had when we visited the famous Mrs. Wilkes dining room in Savannah, Georgia. It's around noon as Jeannie, our five children, and I pile out of the taxi and see a line formed around the block on a beautiful brick-paved, tree-lined, historic Savannah Street. When I see the sheer number of people waiting outside to be seated for lunch, I know Jeannie will, again, be mad at me. Anyone with young children knows long lines don't mix well with toddlers. Leaving the house in general really doesn't mix with toddlers, but long lines just indicate poor parental planning and judgment. That day's adventure was another classic example of Jim choosing food over family. In a precautionary response, I turned to Jeannie. It will be worth it. The line is filled with nicely dressed retirees. It feels a little like an open casting call for actors needed to play country club members. They are all here for Mrs. Wilkes' Southern-style boarding house dining experience. Soon enough, we are sitting at one of the large tables for 10 that my loud brood will share with strangers, Benihana style. We don't order. Within a moment, the table is covered with every foreseeable comfort food that George Wendt could think of. The meal is amazing. The conversation is minimal. Plates and bowls of fried chicken, cornbread dressing, sweet potato souffle, black-eyed peas, okra gumbo, macaroni and cheese, cornbread muffins, and biscuits are shuffled around with the occasional, oh, you have to try this. Like magic, you could take 3 scoops of something out of a bowl, and its contents would not diminish at all. All these separate items would mix together on the plate into new combinations and blend into some other amazing thing that superseded the original taste. The whole was definitely greater than the sum of its parts. Now, I have a powerful appetite, but at this meal, the endless bowls and plates of food conquered it. Eventually, I had to declare, the South has won. Unlike Thanksgiving dinner, where you can, a few hours later, go back into battle to relive some of the more glorious moments with the turkey sandwich, at Mrs. Wilkes', there are no doggy bags. They literally will not allow you to take any unfinished food out of the restaurant. It is like an episode of The Twilight Zone. The endless, awe-inspiring food and the ethereally historic atmosphere of the dining room can only exist together. Removing one from the other could somehow diminish the power of the delectable time machine that is Mrs. Wilkes. The dining room is located on the lower level of the late 19th century boarding house that the original Mrs. Wilkes ran for more than 50 years. Mrs. Wilkes' goal was to offer her guests comfortable lodging and Southern-style home-cooked meals in a very simple yet elegant setting. I never understood why the boarding house concept was such an important part of the Southern culture until I experienced the meal that day. After eating 10 pounds of fried chicken and side dishes, what person would ever have the energy to get up and actually go somewhere? Of course, you would want to board. It was all I could do to stop myself from crawling upstairs and passing out in someone's bed. Of course, though, I didn't. That would be ridiculous. I did the right thing and had Jeannie and the kids carry me back to the hotel. Super Bowl Sunday Foodland. The first Sunday in February is a special day in the United States. It's the day of the Super Bowl, the championship game between the winners of the American Football Conference and the National Football Conference. People throw parties to watch the game and judge the commercials. I love football and enjoy the commercials, but what I mostly enjoy is the food served at Super Bowl parties. What is served on Super Bowl Sunday feels like a homecoming of all the great unhealthy American foods. There are dishes that taste great with beer and are all easy to eat while watching television. What could be more American than that? Hot dogs, pizza, and buffalo wings are great examples of Super Bowl Sunday foods. After traveling all around this amazing country, I've discovered that the deepest appreciation of and love for these Super Bowl Sunday foods can be found in the Midwest. I grew up in the Midwest, or the flyover part of the United States. To many on the coast, the Midwest is mostly boring, or at its best, charmingly boring. While I don't agree, I can empathize with this sentiment. I remember when I was 10 years old, looking around at my small Indiana town that didn't even have a McDonald's and thinking, I'm not supposed to be here. There's been some mistake. Was I switched at birth? I am not a Midwesterner. Of course, when I finally got to New York City, the first thing I discovered was that I am a Midwesterner. To the ethnocentric New York City comedy scene of the 1990s, comedians were Jewish, Italian, Puerto Rican, or African American, and I quickly learned that my ethnicity was Midwestern. I was a pale piece of white bread floating in a sea of ethnicity, and I loved it. To make matters more romantic, I was from Indiana, which to many is considered the trailer park of the Midwest, or simply an I state. I once had someone ask me if I rode a tractor to school. Obviously not, I explained. Only the rich kids had tractors. In some ways, it's understandable why people have an almost dismissive view of the Midwest. It seems like everything in the Midwest was named in an effort to trick people into moving there. After all, the Midwest is not geographically in the West, or even in the middle of the country. There must have been an exchange between someone loading up a stagecoach and a government official desperately trying to get people to settle in the Midwest in the early 1800s. Government official, I see you're moving. Where are you going? Settler, well, I heard about the gold rush in California. I'm heading out west. Government official, have you thought about the Midwest? Settler, Midwest? Where's that? Government official, it's close to the West. It's in the middle. Well, it's in the eastern part of the middle of the western part of, well, there's plains, and those plains are great. That's why it's called the Great Plains in the Midwest. Settler, I think I just want to go out west. Did I mention the lakes in the Midwest? Great lakes. In fact, one is so great they named it Superior. There's great plains, great lakes, great everything. Did I mention it's the breadbasket of the country? Bread's free in the Midwest. Okay, I guess I'll go. So in the true spirit of the American settlers, we set up camp in the middle of nowhere, were bored and freezing, and we created delicious food that would be perfect to eat in February while drinking beer and watching football. Chicago. I grew up in Northwest Indiana, which is a suburb of Chicago. I love telling people in Chicago I'm from Indiana. There's usually a perplexed look of, where's that? I then explain that Indiana is the bordering state, which is 10 minutes away. I had one Chicago woman describe Indiana to me as the state with the road to Michigan in it. All these insults aside, I forgive you, Chicago. I love Chicago and Chicago food. Chicago is famous for its deep dish pizza, but that is not the only local specialty. If a city is lucky, they will have one food specialty. Buffalo has wings. Philly has cheesesteaks. Chicago has so many. The best hot dog, the best Italian beef, and of course the best pizza are all in Chicago. Now, before Northeasterners get all defensive about New York-style, New Jersey-style, New Haven-style pizza, let's embrace this fact. There is great pizza in many different cities, but Chicago is the only place to get deep dish. It's the only place that deep dish makes sense. Only Midwesterners would be patient enough to wait an hour for deep dish, or gluttonous enough to actually eat deep dish. Chicago deep dish takes forever to cook, and costs as much as four New York-style pizzas. Chicago deep dish is a commitment. You arrive at Uno's, Giordano's, Gino's East, or Lou Malnati's, and place your order. And then you wait and wait for what seems like a lifetime. At times, it feels like they are purposely tormenting you to make the deep dish pizza seem all the more appealing. I actually make a point of not showing up hungry when I go out for a Chicago deep dish pizza. It would be torture. To kill time, you eat a salad with provolone salami and pepperoncinis in it, and drink a pitcher of beer like you were preparing yourself for some kind of long, difficult journey of waiting. Finally, your pizza arrives in a pan carried by your server with some kind of clamp contraption that I'm pretty sure is the same one they use to shape molten glass. After the first slice, you are full, and you should be. You've eaten roughly 3 pounds of food that is baked on top of a crispy cake-like crust. There is never a reason to eat more than one slice of deep dish, but you forge on. The wait has built an enthusiasm and an excitement in you that can't be quelled by just one slice. Most humans stop after 2 slices, but I like to think of myself as a superhuman. My brother Joe, who lives in Chicago, makes fun of my love for Chicago-style deep-dish pizza. It's for tourists. I don't care. Last March, I brought my 9 and 8-year-olds for their first deep-dish, and they thought it was weird. Weird? I immediately demanded a paternity test to see if they were actually my children. Wisconsin. Every December, Jeannie and I and our 500 children travel to Milwaukee for the holidays. It's hard enough to eat healthy during the holidays. In Wisconsin, it's impossible. We usually are in Wisconsin for about 10 pounds. That means 1 week for those of you who have never visited Wisconsin. That is how time is measured in Wisconsin. Well, it should be. How long have you been in Wisconsin? 40 pounds. Oh, you came during Summerfest. I don't know if it's possible to visit Wisconsin and not gain weight. Eating healthy doesn't seem like an option in Wisconsin. I don't think they even sell salads. Well, why should they? Wisconsin is the home of the Butterburger, the Kringle, the Bratwurst, and cheese. Lots and lots of cheese. Eating healthy in Wisconsin makes as much sense as going to rehab in Amsterdam. It just doesn't work. Some of my favorite things on this planet are from Wisconsin. Beer, bratwurst, cheese, and of course my wife Jeannie, in that order. Good food is everywhere you look. If you visit someone's house in Wisconsin, a cheese plate is put out. It could be 11 in the morning or 10 o'clock at night. There will be a tray with cheddar cheese and summer sausage. As a result of this plethora of edible happiness, people in Wisconsin eat all the time. Eating is important in Wisconsin. Even their beloved Green Bay football team is called the Packers. The state is about eating. It makes sense that the serial killer from Milwaukee was also eating his victims. He was simply doing what a serial killer from Wisconsin should do. Cincinnati. Often there seems to be a logic behind a local specialty. Omaha and Texas should have great steaks given the cattle that are raised and packaged there. Italian beef in Chicago and bratwurst in Wisconsin make sense given the Italian and German immigrants who settled there. From my uneducated viewpoint, chili makes no sense for Cincinnati. Even what they do with the chili in Cincinnati makes no sense. They serve it over pasta, yet somehow it works. Chili in Cincinnati is not just a local culinary specialty. It's an industry. There are thriving fast food chili franchises in the Cincinnati area. The story goes that a Greek immigrant in the 1920s wanted to cater to the local taste buds, so he started serving chili over spaghetti at his hot dog stand, which I'm pretty sure makes no sense whatsoever. Either way, Cincinnati chili does appeal to people like me who have trouble deciding between 2 entrees. I'm always amazed that they have drive-through chili places. For sure, the most dangerous item to eat in a car would have to be spaghetti, with chili a close second. I'm surprised they don't make you eat it with chopsticks. Texting while driving seems less complicated. St. Louis. St. Louis is famous for its thin crust pizza, which almost seems like an overreaction to the Chicago deep dish pizza. But when I contemplate St. Louis food, I think of toasted ravioli. Maybe in St. Louis they call a deep fryer a toaster, because I'm pretty sure St. Louis toasted ravioli is just deep fried ravioli. Calling deep fried ravioli toasted is a little like calling World War II an extended argument. Toasted ravioli are delicious, but you have to eat them right away or they will turn into rocks. When did you cook these? 1 minute ago? Now we call them St. Louis diamonds. Many people don't know the St. Louis Arch was constructed completely out of toasted ravioli a minute after they came out of the deep fryer. Buffalo. Okay, Buffalo's not technically located in the Midwest, but it is a Great Lakes city with a Midwestern heart. The mere fact that it is the birthplace of buffalo wings makes it an honorary Midwestern destination. I'm not sure how eating chicken wings covered in spicy sauce makes watching sporting events on television so appealing, but it does. I assume most of you savages listening to this eat chicken wings, also known as buffalo wings. Those are baby chickens' wings you are mindlessly dunking in delicious blue cheese dressing. I don't like to eat the baby bird's wings. I'm not a barbarian. This is why I prefer to eat their legs. I'd rather not take away a bird's ability to fly. I realize some of you are thinking, Jim, while you are brilliant and handsome, you must realize chickens can't fly.
How do we know chickens can't fly? Maybe the chickens have become too dependent on those legs. Legs are just making birds lazy.
Have you ever seen footage of a hippo crossing a river? There's always a bird sitting on its back. How lazy is that bird? It's going to take that hippo 10 minutes to cross the river. That bird could just glide across. It's pathetic, really. That bird sitting on the back of the hippo, I want to eat their legs. Mostly because I'm pro-hippo. I relate to the hippo. The hippo kind of looks like what would happen to a rhino if it ate Super Bowl Sunday foods. Based on the appearance of the hippo, it's surprising that it's not indigenous to the Midwest.
Mexican food land.
I hope it's not considered offensive that my favorite food from the southwestern part of the United States is the food from the neighboring country of Mexico. It shouldn't be insulting, given that Texas and parts of the southwestern United States were once part of Mexico. We may have taken the land after the Mexican-American War, but at least we were polite enough to keep the food, culture, and most of the street names. I'm convinced that anyone who doesn't like Mexican food is a psychopath. Mexican food is so good, you'd think the real immigration problem would be fat guys like me sneaking across the border into Mexico.
I always imagine a pudgy blonde guy being led by handcuffs into a paddy wagon saying, "I just needed some good guacamole!"
It is a known fact that it is impossible to eat quality Mexican food and not be in a good mood afterward. Even bad Mexican food is better than 90% of all other foods.
I used to be a waiter in a Mexican restaurant in Indiana.
Yes, Indiana. That's where you want to go for Mexican food. Indiana or Belgium. Actually, Indiana, like much of the Midwest, has a vibrant Mexican-American community, so the Mexican food where I'm from was quite good. Then again, it's hard to screw up basic Mexican food. The Midwestern suburban Mexican food I grew up with consisted of the same four ingredients. As a waiter, I was asked a lot of questions with the same answer.
What are nachos?
Nachos
are tortilla with cheese, meat, and vegetables. Oh, well then what is a burrito?
Tortilla with cheese, meat, and vegetables.
Well then what is a tostada?
Tortilla with cheese, meat, and vegetables.
Well then what is...
Look, it's all the same stuff. Why don't you say a Spanish word and I'll bring you something delicious made out of tortilla, cheese, meat, and vegetables.
It's all the same stuff in different shapes. It's almost like a conspiracy. Like they had a meeting 200 years ago in Mexico and some guy stood up and said,
"Hey, look, the reason I got everyone here is pretty simple. I figure we could rename this one entree 7 times and sell it to the Americans. Now, who's in on it?" Then one guy in the back stood up and said, "Wouldn't that be dishonest? Well, if you keep your mouth shut, we'll name one of the entrees after you. What's your name?" "My name's Chimichanga." That's a true story.
The best Mexican, Mexican-American, Tex-Mex food is found in places like San Diego, Los Angeles, Albuquerque, and, of course, Texas. Here are some of the great Mexican food specialties. Guacamole. I eat a lot of guacamole. If I died right now, I'm sure some of my children would just remember me as the balding guy who brought home the overpriced, delicious green dip. I hope at one point some really important person sat the inventor of guacamole down and told him or her, "You are a great human. We thank you for your contribution to our planet." Guacamole is made with the avocado, which is so delicious. I think it should be reclassified as a cheese. When guacamole is on the table, I tend to feel sorry for salsa because guacamole gets all the attention. It is always eaten right away because it is that good, and also because exposure to oxygen turns it brown in a matter of minutes. Guacamole should be chunky. Non-chunky guacamole just makes me sad. Churros. Churros are originally from Spain, but since I've given credit to Wisconsin for the German bratwurst in this book, I should probably blame Mexico for the churro. If you don't know what a churro is, just try to picture a rib donut stick. A churro is not fluffy like a donut, but rather hard and crunchy. It's like a pipe cleaner of pastry. Churros are sold at fairs or any place that might sell cotton candy or other foods you should never eat. Churros are also sold at places we should never eat, like a New York City subway platform. I've only had one churro in my life. The guy who sold it to me almost seemed surprised that I was buying it. I then realized I'd never seen anyone actually eat a churro. Maybe the guy who sold me the churro went home and yelled up to his roommate, "Hey, churro, get down here. Remember that sugary bread wine you came up with when you were drunk? Well, I finally sold one today."
Queso.
Whenever I'm in Texas, I have to get queso. Well, I don't have to, but I do anyway. Queso is an amazing combination of melted cheese and chili peppers that I seem to crave once I enter the Lone Star State. It's a bowl of cheesy Nirvana served with chips as an appetizer in Tex-Mex places. It's like that nasty pump cheese they put on nachos at movies, but not made out of recycled park benches. Queso even means cheese in Spanish. It's like eating a block of spicy cheese, but without being interrupted by the annoying cheese chewing. I like to think of queso as an unhealthy cousin of guacamole, and a great way to get full to the point of physical discomfort before they even start cooking your entree. Green chili. New Mexico is really passionate about the green chili, and it's understandable. I'm amazed that the green chili does not have a greater national popularity. They are that good. Unlike the taste explosion of a jalapeno, the flavor of a green chili is balanced, consistent, and of course, delicious. Comparing the jalapeno to the green chili is the same as comparing a burst of freezing cold air on a hot day to sitting in an air-conditioned room. In New Mexico, the green chili is more than a simple ingredient. It is a necessity. They have green chili stews, green chili burgers, green chili pizza, green chili hash browns, and these are not stunt dishes. These are the most popular items on the menu in New Mexico restaurants. At times, I think the reason why the green chili is not a nationwide phenomenon is because the people of New Mexico are secretly hoarding the tasty green chilies. They are hiding them from the rest of us. Everyone I've encountered in Albuquerque seems to have them in bulk stored in their freezer as if there's an impending green chili shortage coming. I had a cab driver once confide, "I've got 10 pounds of green chili in my freezer." I didn't even ask her about green chili. She just brought it up out of the blue. And you know what? I was impressed and a little jealous. The green chili addiction is one I understand. New Mexicans treat their green chilies like contraband. Sometimes if you drive around New Mexico, you will see locals selling green chili tamales out of an open trunk on the side of the road, and people are pulling over to buy them. Green chilies are exciting and a little dangerous. You have to wear gloves when peeling a roasted green chili, or your hands will burn. If I lived in New Mexico, I'd be eating so many green chilies, I would have to get a hazmat suit. I've heard there's talk of reshooting all the episodes of Breaking Bad, but instead of meth, Walter and Jesse sell green chilies. I can't wait. Fried bread. The only thing more astounding than the dramatic beauty of the Southwest is the fact that people are eating fried bread. There is unhealthy eating throughout the United States, but in New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah, there are stands that only sell fried bread. When I first saw that, all I could think was, I found my people. I realize a donut is also fried bread, but at least we don't call it fried bread. In some parts of the Southwest, fried bread is called fry bread. It's like a call to action. If you aren't fat already, fry bread. Let's get fat. Fried bread is very neutral and can pretty much go with anything. It is used in place of the shell for spicy tacos, covered in honey and sugar as a dessert, or just snacked on in its natural form. Fried bread is like the unhealthy Switzerland of the food world. At what point do you even feel comfortable eating something called fried bread? I'd love to hear the interview to decide if someone is prepared to become part of the fried bread culture.
Have you ever eaten cake in the shower?
A couple times.
You may be ready for fried bread. Ever eaten in your car so you don't have to share with your children?
Every day.
You're ready for fried bread.
Fried bread, by its very name, goes against all the basic rules of healthy eating. It is the opposite of a diet.
Diet doctor. Okay, I'm putting you on a strict diet. Here are the rules. No bread, no fried food.
Okay, well, what about fried bread?
Is there like a fried bread only diet?
I don't judge the fried bread eaters. I admire them. They are much more honest than most of us. We eat fried bread, but we do it in code.
Would you like fried bread?
Never. I'll just have an elephant ear.
Would you like fried bread?
Of course not. I'm a debutante. I'll just have a beignet. We have a million names for fried bread, but in the end, it's all fried bread. We just want to eat fried bread and have no one find out about it. We are like that guy at the party trying to find weed. Hey, is your friend Herb going to be here tonight?
Who?
You know, he hangs around the other guy named Bud.
I still don't know what you're talking about.
You know, he's going out with that girl from Mexico named Mary Juana.
Sorry, I don't know that dude. Hey, you want to smoke some pot?
Wineland.
It's always fascinating interacting with crowds after shows. I can get a sense of each city or state's identity and what they are proud of while meeting audience members. Some states are very vocal.
We're from New York and we're tough. We're from Texas and we like things big. My home state is more like, we're from Indiana and we're gonna move.
After shows in some cities, audience members will express gratitude for the show. And then they will add in an apologetic thank you for coming to their town.
I'm sorry you had to come all the way here. Can you take me with you?
Being from a small town in Indiana, I can relate to that feeling.
Sorry, there's nothing cool here.
The one place I never encounter even a hint of low geographic self-esteem is Northern California. This is understandable since NorCal is so beautiful, rich, and relaxed. It's an abundant, good world in Northern California, and the residents know it. It's not arrogance. It's just grateful awareness. Everyone in Northern California seems to be healthy, financially stable, and drinking wine. Did I mention the wine? It's flowing everywhere in Northern California. It is wine country, so it's no surprise that fine wine in NorCal is as common as Budweiser in St. Louis. Wine is a key element of the culture, and it is overemphasized with gracious abandon. Bottles of wine are gifted to me after every show I do in Northern California. The outdoor stages are located in wineries so beautiful, I feel like I'm performing in a painting. Last year, I even performed at a wine-themed music festival called Bottle Rock. Yes, bottle refers to a wine bottle, and yes, I was given bottles of wine there, too. I enjoy wine, but I'm certainly not an expert. My knowledge pretty much ends at the difference between red and white. My ignorance is usually hidden from the world until I'm handed a wine list when I go out to dinner. Does anyone really know what they're looking at when they look at a wine list? Because if you do, I think you're probably an alcoholic.
Yeah, I had three of these for breakfast.
I pretend to read over the binder of 8,000 wines with an inquisitive look on my face, but I don't know what I'm looking at. I can never remember the names of the wines I enjoyed in the past because during those times I was, well, drinking wine. Occasionally I'll make the mistake of asking about which wine the waiter would suggest. They always seem to point to one of the more expensive wines.
Well, this wine would complement your meal.
I always think to myself, is there a box of wine you'd recommend? Because that would complement my wallet. Wine intimidates me. At fancy restaurants, all the names and types of wine seem infinite. It's like no wine name can appear on more than one wine list. Every time I open one of those huge wine list books, I try to identify one wine that I've seen before, but I just end up looking like an idiot. It's exactly like that nightmare you have before finals in high school, where you don't recognize anything on the test, and it all looks like gibberish. When it comes to the fancy wine list, I am 100% white trash hick. There is an inherent formality with wine. It is absolutely necessary to drink wine out of a wine glass. Drinking wine out of anything else is just kind of pathetic.
Hey, can you refill my Yahtzee shaker and hit this sippy cup too, will you? Danke.
Wine formality reaches its apex when you are responsible for tasting a newly opened bottle of wine when you are out to dinner. A feeling of anxiety always comes over me. All confidence seems to evaporate as I take the sample sip. What does good wine taste like? What does bad wine taste like? I usually just look at the waiter and say, yeah, that's wine, all right. Fill her up.
Coffee Land.
It is impossible to talk about coffee and not think about the Pacific Northwest. Seattle changed the way we drink coffee, well, at least what we pay for coffee. Starbucks, Tully's, Dutch Brothers, and Seattle's Best all come from the upper left-hand corner of the map. While all have excellent coffee, in a popularity contest, Starbucks wins. Starbucks coffee is everywhere. It's in malls, hotels, and even in some restrooms of existing Starbucks. It's insane to think that one day, not that long ago, John Starbuck asked his wife, "What if we serve strong coffee at 300 degrees and charge $5 for it?" I like to think coffee comes from beans, therefore it's a vegetable. Coffee is the only thing most of us have for breakfast, or in my case, when I wake up in the afternoon. Coffee is a staple of our lives. Coffee plays such an important role in my life. I've contemplated getting coffee a Christmas present. I was thinking a mug that says world's greatest vegetable. I need coffee to get out of bed and get through the day. However, after 15 cups of coffee, I do feel there is a diminishing return. It almost seems as if it starts to have the opposite effect.
As processing all that caffeine exhausts my system, at times coffee just feels to me like a sleeping potion with a delayed time release that can only be remedied by additional coffee. Even the person who decided on the spelling of the word coffee seems to have had too much caffeine. Initially, I was reluctant to pay more than a dollar for a cup of coffee. Coffee shops like Starbucks and their boutique coffee shop competitors seemed annoying to me. Why was everyone so pompous and aloof? I'm here for coffee, not to write the next great American novel. I didn't understand why the espresso machine was the size of a station wagon, or why I should have to wait longer to pay more for a cup of coffee. I thought of coffee as just a caffeine delivery device, but eventually I came to care deeply about the taste. The desire for good taste in coffee is a secondary step in the coffee addiction. First, you get addicted to the crutch of caffeine and coffee. Then you find your taste preference. I was seduced by the flavor of good coffee. I like my coffee strong, black, and frequent. Okay, expensive strong coffee, you win. I'm lost without you. Where do I send all my money? At this point, weak coffee angers me, and I believe brewing it like that should be considered a crime. The wait I encounter in coffee shops still annoys me a little. I hold myself back from barking at the people in line before me. Just order! You're getting a beverage, not picking a college to attend. I'm impatient, but I still wait. I'm a serious coffee drinker, and I have to stand in line with others like me, as well as the amateurs. I go to coffee shops for good coffee, and amateurs go for coffee-flavored milkshakes. I find it humorous that adults have found a way to use coffee shops as a means to not look ridiculous by walking around in broad daylight with a huge cup of ice cream with a straw in it. It's a frappuccino. I'm an adult. I used to not appreciate the employees in coffee shops. They seem too snobby and nonchalant and slow. There is not being in a hurry slow, and then there is I work in a boutique coffee shop slow. The coffee shop employees always seem like they could use some caffeine themselves. I remember thinking to myself, who the hell does that guy think he is? Now I understand that the people who work in coffee shops are entitled to act self-important. After all, they are the first responders of everyone's day. They are delivering the first fix of caffeine to all us addicts, and they have to take their time, or it could become Armageddon. They are heroes, really, or drug dealers. Either way, they are allowed to be jerks. Thank you, arrogant coffee shop employee. Food Anxiety Land. Traveling around doing stand-up, you learn about the uniqueness of certain cities. A stand-up comedian knows they will be competing for an audience with amazing music scenes in Nashville and Austin. In New York, Las Vegas, and Chicago, you will contend with an enormous entertainment scene. You'd never schedule a show in any Canadian city if the local hockey team, NHL, or minor league has a game. In New Orleans, it is a different situation. In New Orleans, you compete against food. Sure, New Orleans has jazz and binge drinking, but the real competition for live stand-up comedy shows is restaurants and food in general. There is great dining in most large cities, but not like the dining in New Orleans. You don't just dine in New Orleans, you overeat. Not overeating in New Orleans is like going to Paris and not looking at the Eiffel Tower. Whenever I'm about to go to New Orleans for a show, I always suffer a food anxiety. I'm not being cute here. There's actually an angst that comes over me. There are just too many decisions. Where should I eat? What should I eat? How often can I eat? Did anyone watch all the episodes of Treme? New Orleans is a food mecca. It is not just the variety. It's the fact that I've never had bad food in New Orleans. I think it may be against the law. Even getting a hot dog from a street cart in New Orleans is a culinary adventure. Typically, a city or a region of the country is known for a particular dish or a type of food that an overeater can track down in a day by asking a local. That is not the case in New Orleans. The breads, meats, and the spices of New Orleans are as fun, unique, and diverse as its inhabitants. The dishes are at once pedestrian and simultaneously exotic. Should I eat Cajun, Creole, fried chicken, beignets? I could go on for a page or two. It's too much. I never have enough time. I think the Po' Boy sandwich was named after a guy who was trying to decide where to eat for his one meal in New Orleans. Settling on a place to eat there is my equivalent of Sophie's Choice. How do I choose one over the other? It's painful. To make matters worse, this issue affects me not only for every meal, but also for every moment of the day.
Sure, for breakfast you need to get a beignet at the tourist trap place. But what about Cajun-style biscuits and gravy? For lunch you have to get jambalaya, but what about chicken and sausage gumbo? Breakfast, lunch, snack, dinner, late-night dinner, pre-breakfast? It's all too overwhelming. I understand people plan actual food vacations to New Orleans under the guise of enjoying jazz, but I'm typically in the Big Easy for one night. One night? That translates into only 6 meals for me. How will I decide? If I had to make a film about my experience in New Orleans, I would definitely get Meryl Streep to play me. At least I don't eat blubber. Every morning I get up at 6 a.m., I meditate, do yoga, drink a protein shake, run 6 miles, then I commence lying to everyone about what I do every morning. The truth is I didn't get a chance to do yoga or jog this morning or any other morning of my life, but those things are more likely to happen than the likelihood of me ever drinking a protein shake. I don't eat healthy. It's difficult to eat healthy. At times I make an effort, but I usually fail. I hate when I try to order a salad. My mouth says I'll have a double quarter pounder with cheese. It's like I have autocorrect in my mouth. My heart may be willing, but my brain abdicated to my taste buds long ago. I'm not a healthy eater. I'm like the Dr. Oz of unhealthy eating. I don't mean this as a criticism of Dr. Oz, who I'm sure is a nice man, but I'm starting to doubt he is really from Australia. Where's your accent, Dr. Oz? Stages of eating healthy. I go through different stages of healthy eating. First, it's the I'm only eating salads phase. Then I'll get to the I've eaten salads for a half a day straight. I should treat myself to a hamburger phase. Finally, I get to the last phase, which I'm in right now, the I don't give a phase. If you're like me, when you enter this last phase, you begin to justify things. I'm in a hurry, so it's just an absolute necessity that I go to McDonald's. I don't want to go. It's just that I have to, or it's possible I could starve to death. Then all your food choices quickly become an endless stream of irrational rationalizations. Well, I'll allow myself to eat that because I had a salad a month ago. Well, I've earned that because I took out the garbage. Well, I'm starting my starvation diet tomorrow, so I really should have 5 hamburgers. My favorite rationalization is when the food is free. I've never been able to turn down free food. Maybe it's because I grew up with 5 siblings and food was always a valuable commodity. Maybe the inability to resist free food has its roots in my college years, when I couldn't afford food and at one point resorted to eating a can of pie filling. Whatever the reason, I just can't resist it if it's free. Free food is the temptress that can make me give up my morals and cheat on any diet. My diets always end in divorce. I'm married to a beautiful woman. I'm not just saying that because Jeannie is helping me write this book and she is sitting right next to me. Well, not right next to me, but chances are she'll be listening to this at some point. But anyway, she is beautiful. When we are in public together and strangers find out Jeannie is my wife, there's usually an audible, wow. I used to find that flattering until I realized it was an insult. I'm not a caveman. Anyway, there are so many impressive things about Jeannie besides her beauty and brain. Most noticeably would be that Jeannie has given birth to 5 healthy babies, and I look like I ate 5 healthy babies. She is a genetic anomaly. It seems she can eat whatever she wants and still remain thin and energetic. Jeannie aspires to make everyone in our family healthy eaters, but it's kind of hard with me around. Jeannie has gone from wanting us to eat healthy to wanting us to eat organic to not buying food. She buys this bread that is made from 100% organic tree bark. Why do you need regular bread when you can lick a tree? Jeannie likes to buy organic whole foods. Organic is probably the biggest scam of the century. For those of you unfamiliar with it, organic is a grocery term for more expensive. There are people who eat only organic food, and then there are the people that don't have tons of money to waste. You can pretty much find anything made organically these days, including healthy versions of unhealthy food. French fries have been replaced by sweet potato fries, which are the garden burgers of fries and taste exactly like something terrible. We all know hot dogs are bad for us, so that's why there is the tofu dog. I'm pretty sure the guy who invented the tofu dog never actually ate a real hot dog. If he had, he would never have invented the tofu dog. Or maybe he tasted a real hot dog after he invented the tofu dog, and was then filled with remorse. The tofu dog became his Frankenstein's monster. Why? Why did I create the tofu dog? We must stop the tofu dog.
There are even organic candies, cookies, and chips that fall into another category known as whole junk food. These foods fit into my rationalization pattern very nicely. These potato chips are cooked with avocado oil, so I can eat 10 bags. It's good for me. Usually the only discernible difference between a regular potato chip and a healthy chip is the difficulty in opening the bag. Supposedly there are good fats and bad fats. I like to think of myself as a good fat. It helps my self-esteem when I look in the mirror. Jeannie loves buying vegetables at the farmer's market. Can we just settle down with the farmer's market enthusiasm? Instead of going to a grocery store and getting everything I need, I can stand outside and buy some dirty vegetables on the street from absolute strangers who supposedly live on a farm but are probably serial killers. How do we know that some of the people selling stuff at the farmer's market didn't just buy that stuff at the grocery store? Some con artist probably came up with the idea.
Psst, give me a kid. This is what we're going to do, see? We're going to go in the grocery store, buy a bunch of unwashed vegetables, then we're going to sell them on the street for 10 times the price. Kid, that'll never work. Just tell them they're from the farms. So they taste better, see? You're a genius, Mac. A genius. We're going to get rich.
It's hard to eat healthy. It's too expensive. Should I have the salad for $12 or these 5 hamburgers for a dime? I resent when I go out to dinner and they try to sell me the healthy food for the same price as the good food. What a ripoff. Even more infuriating is the way the waiter tries to present the healthy choice on the menu as if it tastes as good as real food.
Tonight we're having a delicious entree of steamed spinach and tofu over a bed of vitamins.
Great. And for dessert, why don't we get our teeth cleaned? I eat kind of healthy compared to some of the Eskimos in Alaska. They're eating blubber up there. Compared to them, I'm practically dieting by eating a Cinnabon. Whale blubber? Isn't that like eating a fat guy? Actually, it would be healthier to eat a fat guy. I don't want to appear to insult Eskimos and their culture, even though I'm starting to think they don't even make those Eskimo pies. I realize the weather is not great in Alaska, but consuming something called blubber is a little insane. They are actually eating something that is a direct result of eating unhealthy. Isn't blubber like the fattest part of fat? If fat made a noise, it would be blubber. You'd think at some point one of the Eskimos would stand up at a meal and say, "Hey, I love blubber. Who doesn't love blubber?" But I was thinking, you know, we could mix in some salads or maybe less blubber. Who knows? Maybe the blubber eaters think we eat weird stuff. Those poor bastards down there don't even eat blubber. If you're eating blubber, what do you consider bad for you? I'm pretty sure drinking liquefied lard might be a healthier choice. On the other hand, maybe we got lucky because of the blubber. It's possibly the reason why Alaska became part of the United States. Maybe the Canadian explorers made it up to Alaska, saw the Eskimos eating blubber, and thought, oh, the Americans already got here. I look forward to the day we can walk into a health food store and see organic whale blubber for sale. Oh, look, it's whole whale blubber. That's really good for you, right? Nobody really likes fruit. Recently I saw an apple, and for a moment I didn't recognize it. Just for a second I was like, what is that? A paperweight? Oh, that's an apple! It's so weird to not see it in a pie. I'm not proud of this, but let's be honest. Nobody really wants fruit. We only act like we do. A false desire for fruit is woven into the fabric of our culture. We are told that Adam and Eve were kicked out of paradise for eating an apple. An apple? Would an apple ever really tempt you? I would have looked at the serpent. An apple? Cover it in caramel and come back to me. You got any cake back there? Sure, people will eat it if there's nothing else around. But given the other options, fruit just isn't that great. Even when people seem excited to see fruit, they're really just relieved it's not vegetables. Fruit involves too much work. You have to wash it. You have to remove that sticker Al-Qaeda put on there. There's work with fruit. Think about the orange. Has peeling an orange ever really been worth it? I always think, there's not even chocolate in this thing. Yet people still imagine they like fruit. Some weirdos even convinced everyone that the gathering of a fruit is a fun activity. Once a friend excitedly asked me, why don't we go apple picking? Because I'd rather die. You have to pay to pick apples.
Okay, how much do I owe you to work for you for free? Don't rip me off. I'm no dummy.
Once in my pre-genie life, I dated a woman who made me go blueberry picking. One August, she said to me, I think I'd like to go blueberry picking. Maybe we should go blueberry picking. I remember thinking, no, no way. They can't even get migrant workers to do that. Yet like 10 seconds later, there I was in upstate New York picking blueberries. I remember thinking, what happened? What am I doing here? The whole experience was much worse than it sounds.